This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Waves that carry the voices of the obscure. Whether Rush Limbaugh or Bill Resnick, the radio is where you will hear these people. And the Old Mole is where you will hear the voices of a collection of eccentrics, leftists, feminists, anarchists, Marxists, academics, and intellectuals. A collection of class backgrounds, scholarly backgrounds, sexual backgrounds. Together we merge every Monday at 9 a.m. to put our voices on the airwaves and allow you, the listener, to surf as you choose. Enjoy the static, enjoy the FM dial, and dare to open your mind to the collective of thought that is Old Mole. As a collective, we try to structure our shows on various themes, this done with varying degrees of success. On today's show, we'll hear Bill Resnick talk with Ben Goldacre, and they discuss how psychopharmacology and the pharmaceutical industry is making us all mentally ill. Alan Wider explores the upcoming Rethinking Psychiatry Film Festival with our own mole Jan Hawkins' documentary Mind Zone playing this Thursday. Movie mole Joel Clement will review the film The Pervert's Guide to Ideology. And finally, Alan Wider again will comment on sports, society, and racism in Israel. There is a common thread in all of this, and there may be a quiz at the end of the show, so stay tuned.
Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted.
So first off, we have senior analyst Bill Resnick talking with Ben Goldacre, the author of Bad Pharma, How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. The manipulated testing of psychoactive drugs can lead to erratic and varied responses in patients. Will this help us stop gun violence or maybe increase the shootings? Bill, tell us.
Goldacre, welcome to KBOO.
Hey, hi, thanks for having me.
Ben Goldacre's first major book was Bad Science. His most recent book that he is now promoting and touring the United States is Bad Pharma, How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. First, Dr. Goldacre, why don't you outline how drug companies mislead doctors and harm patients?
So it's important to be clear, this isn't like a conspiracy theory book, and it's also not a self-help book. This is a book about how we test drugs, how we measure their benefits and also their risks, and then how we bring all that information together and get it out to doctors and patients so that they can make informed decisions. And my concern is that there are distortions in this system, which means that people don't always get the best treatment for them. And that's for a number of different reasons. Firstly, sometimes clinical trials, which we like to imagine are these perfect processes, sometimes they're flawed by design in such a way that they're not fair tests of whether a treatment works or not. Sometimes you see biased dissemination, if you like. So you see through marketing, doctors are given a slanted view about the relative merits of different treatments. But I think the most important thing of all is that clinical trials can go missing in action. So a drug company is allowed to do lots and lots of trials on a drug and then only publish the ones that they want to. And we know from the best currently available evidence that about half of all clinical trials never get published. We know that trials with positive results are about twice as likely to get published as trials with negative results. And that means that the evidence base that we use for making decisions in medicine is biased overall. And that's not just a problem for drug company research, actually. It's a problem for independent academic research as well.
Let's talk about that in a little more detail. The negative results are somehow buried. The positive results get disseminated and told to doctors. We'll get into that, and advertised to patients. How does that happen? What are the regulators doing? What are the academic journals, you know, who allegedly should be publishing these things? Why aren't they?
Well, for many years, there were no laws or codes of conduct about this at all. And that's a real issue. I mean, we knew about this problem from the mid-1980s onwards. it wasn't until, I guess, maybe 12 years ago that people even thought about trying to fix it. Now, the trouble is, we brought in various regulations in the last 5 or 7 years. So, for example, in 2005, a law was brought in, not a law, but a code of conduct saying that you have to register all of your trials.
This is in the United Kingdom.
No, this is international.
Uh-huh.
So people recognized that this was an issue, and the medical journal editors of the world got together and they said, okay, well, what we can do is everybody who does a trial, if it has a positive result, they want to publish it in a glamorous academic medical journal, a major academic medical journal like New England Journal of Medicine. So what we'll do is we'll say you're only allowed to publish a trial in one of our journals if you've registered it, if you've posted it on a publicly accessible list of trials. And the idea was that if you forced people to post lists of all the trials that they conducted and completed, then at least we'd have some way of doing an audit and spotting whether all of them had been published or not. And everybody celebrated in 2005 when this law was passed by something called the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors. And it wasn't until 5 years later that we found out that they'd completely ignored their own rules. So half of all the trials that got published in the big journals still weren't registered properly, and a quarter weren't registered at all. Now, if your eyes are glazing over, that's kind of an illustration of how, you know, this is about the nerdy details of our failures rather than horror stories about how drugs are killing you. So the second thing which everybody cites as a fix for the problem, but which unfortunately was just a fake fix, is something called the FDA Amendment Act 2007. And the idea with this law was you have to post the results of all clinical trials conducted in the US on any medicine that's currently being prescribed. You have to post the results on a website called clinicaltrials.gov within a year of the completion of that trial. And again, everybody rejoiced as if this had fixed the problem. There was no routine public audit of whether people were actually doing what they were supposed to do. And when an audit was finally published in the British Medical Journal in 2012, just last year, it found that the rate of compliance with this law was just 22%. So 4 out of 5 trials had failed to comply with this law. And yet, the FDA have never once levied a fine on any company or researcher for withholding information. And even if they had, it's $10,000 a day, and I guess that would be quite a lot for you or me to pay. But it's $3.5 million a year. And for a big organization or for a big company that's got a revenue of billions on one drug, that's a parking ticket, really.
Yeah, it's a chicken fee.
And in any case, no such fine has ever been levied. And what I find really disappointing is that even if this law had worked perfectly, it still would have done nothing to improve the evidence base that we use to make decisions in medicine today, because about 80% of the medicines used in America have been on the market for more than 10 years. So that means that most of the trials that were done, which we used to try and inform our decision-making about those medicines, were also done 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. So we know that drug companies and institutions have all of the trials from that era, and that's the information that we really need to make informed decisions about the medicines we use today. If we passed a law tomorrow, it would be useless if it said, oh, you have to hand over all the results of all the trials that are completed after June 2013. That wouldn't help us make decisions in medicine until 2033. What we need is to get the evidence from the past 20 years, the era during which doctors, academics, regulators, and industry have all dithered on the problem.
A lot of people in the know this. I don't think it's a secret. It's a secret from the public, but not from the regulators, not even in Congress. There have been, in the U.S. Congress, hearings over the years that have looked at some of these questions. At least it's not completely new to me. The New York Times now and then does an expose. The companies have an enormous amount of power, apparently. We'll get into that. We'll get into that in the second half of the interview.
I'm not sure I agree, actually, that everybody knows about this. I mean, it's definitely true that regulators know about it and companies do. I'm not sure, actually, doctors know enough about this. And I think one of the really heinous things about all of the legislation that's been passed but then not enforced is that it's lulled people into a real false sense of security. So the reason why I wrote this book is that I realized people were talking as if these were problems of the past that had been fixed, even amongst reasonably savvy doctors and academics that I was spending time with. But there's also an issue of cultural blind spots, because for some reason, I think a lot of people in medicine and academia haven't really felt it in their belly that if you erase entire clinical trials with negative results, that's still research misconduct. It still distorts the evidence that we have. Yeah. For some reason, it's never shown up in the codes of conduct or anything like that.
Yeah. Is it a cultural, this is a really interesting issue, is it a cultural blindness or is it a sort of learned and required response to the problems of medicine? So medicine sells itself as being able to cure problems. In fact, what's always amazing to me, very, very rich people die of all of the common diseases. They get heart attacks, they get cancer, they know about it, and medicine can't do anything for them, regardless of how much money they have. They may put off the death by a year or two with really good care, or maybe 3 years or whatever, but in fact, medicine can't cure things, and yet medicine sells itself in some ways to people who really desperately want cures. And the drug companies give them these methods of at least doing something. And it seems to me that it's a kind of, doctors don't want to say that the stuff that they prescribe and do will likely not be very useful. That's a kind of lesson. They don't want to learn that any more than the patients, is my guess.
Okay, so there's a lot there that I disagree with very strongly.
Oh, yes.
I mean, medicine does do a lot of good. There are lots of things which we don't have fantastic treatments for. But, I mean, there are plenty of things also that are cured. I mean, antibiotics genuinely
sure.
do
broken
get
legs.
Rid of bacteria.
I mean, there's a lot of really good things.
But yes. There are also lots of very good treatments for cancers. There are very good treatments for heart disease. It's really interesting to look at changes in mortality and what drives it. And it's a mixture of public health and direct medical interventions. But it's very rare that medicine advances by a sudden epoch-making breakthrough. Your chances of dying as a middle-aged man have roughly halved over the past 3 or 4 decades. But that's not because of any single amazing breakthrough. It's a gradual accumulation of our understanding of very modest shifts in risks mm-hmm. and benefits, which overall add up to something very significant. I mean, my concern is not that medicine is hopeless. My concern is that we're misled about which is the most effective and also which is the most cost-effective treatment. So if we took an example of statins, for example, that lower cholesterol and that also prevent heart attack and stroke. So there are lots of interesting issues there. Firstly, does everybody want to take a pill that halves their risk of having a heart attack or stroke? Well, some people do. Some people don't. I've no strong feeling. I would offer it to a patient, but I wouldn't force it upon them, and I don't think anybody would. But the second issue that I'm really interested in is which statin is the best, and what are the barriers to us finding that out?
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, having a discussion with Dr. Ben Goldacre. His recent book is Bad Pharma, How Drug Companies Mislead Doctors and Harm Patients. Dr. Goldacre, we've been talking about the virtues of medicine and of modern medicine, but also a lot of the limitations of modern medicine. And your specialty is drug testing and the real limitations on drug testing and how many, even though many drugs are very useful, a lot of them may well not be. And the test regimen is not, in fact, revealing which ones really work and which ones don't. Is that a fair way of...
I think it's fairly unusual that drugs get on the market which do more harm than good or which are completely useless. It certainly happens from time to time, but I think that's fairly unusual. What I'm concerned by is that our systems for measuring which treatment is best are so flawed that people are sometimes misled into using, for example, the third best drug in a class when actually they could be getting the better drug and they would get more benefit from that because they've been misled about the evidence through a combination of flawed trials, biased dissemination, and so on. And I think that's kind of where the meat and the action is. I don't think it's actually very common that there are treatments out there that are completely useless.
I want to change courses a little bit. I think that the harm, though, that's done, there are two types. One is just not getting the right medicine, sometimes getting harmful medicine for them, tests that don't identify whether it works well for some people and not others. There's so much that should be done, I gather you think, with regard to the testing. The other point is, if that's wrong, you can correct me, but the other point is, that you talk about some, is sort of the medicalization of social problems and human troubles. Often medicalization, it seems to me, at least in the United States, and I'm sure in England as well, particularly for behavioral problems and mental health problems, the medical profession and the drug companies often advertise themselves as helping to really reduce the pain to patients, and sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. But that those mental health problems are now being seen not as a function of a society that drives a lot of people crazy from insecurity and demoralization and constant humiliation. That's what I see. And there's crazy people, of course, at every class level. But it really, the insecurity for poor people is enormous, especially in this society. And it leads to a lot of stress and a lot of troubles. The medical model is used rather than the social change model. And people also are told, well, pop these pills, maybe you'll get better, rather than it's a long struggle and you have to be involved in it and actually become a subject of your life rather than just popping pills. What do you make of that critique?
As you say, I'm a dork and I'm really interested in the flaws in how we measure the risks and benefits of treatments. And nobody should buy this book imagining it's anything other than a very nerdy tale of how clinical trials are distorted. But you're absolutely right. I mean, this sits in a broader cultural context. And one of the things I think is interesting is we've made clinical trials and medical research very, very expensive with a lot of administrative red tape. I think we overmanage some of the more trivial ethical and practical problems in clinical trials, especially when they're on well-established treatments that are safe. And because we've made trials so expensive, and I'm talking about clinical trials of treatments that are already in everyday use, not of, you know, brand new dangerous cancer drugs. Because we've made trials so expensive, we've made it such that you can only gather good evidence, you can only kind of build a model if you have a lot of money behind you. So we've made it much more challenging to do trials of cheaper medicines and of social interventions. And I think that's a real problem. And then secondly, on top of that, as you say, you know, there are big kind of marketing operations driving any kind of solution for mental health problems that involves a commodity that you can sell, like a pill. And other kinds of interventions like social interventions or talking therapies may not have that kind of money behind them. That said, though, there's also a really simple kind of issue of where society is willing to spend money. Antidepressant medication now that's generic and is off patent, you know, it's a couple of dollars a month. And I don't think there's anywhere that anyone can deliver talking treatments for a couple of dollars a month. And I suppose what you're talking about is a complete reconfiguration of where society puts its priorities and what should go first. And I'm inclined to agree with you. I would like to live in a utopia in which people were much more focused on well-being, in which the social cues all around us and the incentives were all much more closely aligned with the things that make people feel happy and fulfilled. That's a big ask.
It is a big ask. That's what we try and do on this show, is prepare people for the day when this society is going to be forced to really, that in fact, all societies on this planet are going to be forced to grapple with those questions. The old model, it seems to us, is in trouble. New models are being developed.
An outsider, right, when you come to America, the thing that you're really struck by is everything is commoditized. There are lots of things which in England, there's a kind of, do you swear on this TV show, radio show, or should I not?
There are seven terrible words. Which ones were you thinking of?
I'll manage around.
Okay.
There's a and giggles. Is that an acceptable phrase?
No. Okay. And we'll have to take it out. So why don't you conclude?
So people in America, it seems to me, want to kind of monetize everything. And there's a certain dynamicism about that, actually. Like it's a bit weird and horrible when you first get here, but actually you can see how people use money to try and get things done in America, and that makes people more dynamic. And I wonder if there is a way of aligning incentives more closely. I wonder if there is a way of kind of trying to capture the more abstract and esoteric pleasures of life that you describe financially, because I'm not sure that we're ever going to completely overturn the entire capitalist monster. You know, maybe not from this from this building.
Well, it's always a struggle. People are in struggle, and they grow in struggle. So we're not going to reach utopia ever. But boy, things, the struggles can be a whole lot more fulfilling, is my line, at least. And it was really good talking to you. I guess I grabbed the last word, but that's how it is to be the interviewee. Thanks a lot for talking to us.
Thanks, Chief.
To see ghetto prince is my thing. Making love's how I swing. I'm your pusher man. I'm your pusher man. Two bags, please, for a generous fee. Make your world what you want it to be. Got a woman I love desperately.
That was Curtis Mayfield, the incomparable Curtis Mayfield with Pusher Man. Before that, in regards to music, we also heard Patsy Cline and Crazy. The last interview we heard was Bill Resnick talking with Ben Goldacre about his book Bad Pharma and how drug companies mislead doctors and harm patients. Starting this Thursday, the 21st, Rethinking Psychiatry opens its film festival with the documentary Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Front Lines, a new documentary film by longtime Old Mole member Jan Hocken. Now, Old Mole Alan Weider is live in the studio with Marcia Myers, founder of Rethinking Psychiatry, and they will tell us about this film and more. Alan.
Thanks, Ivan. Marcia, thanks for being with us. Marcia was the founder of Rethinking Psychiatry, which is actually part of the Economic Justice Action Group of the First Unitarian Church. And so before we get to the film festival, which Ivan has already obviously said we're here to talk about, can you talk a little bit about the organization?
I can say that what I did, being a founder or whatever, is just see that this is a huge issue, as the gentleman right before me pointed out. And when I heard Robert Whitaker, who wrote a book about exactly what he was talking about, the epidemic of the anatomy of an epidemic, psychiatric drugs, mental illness, and the amazing rise of mental illness in America, he was looking at the lack of really good scientific evidence for a story that we are living under as far as what is mental health. And when I heard him speak, I realized that it was an economic issue, because the story that we have accepted pretty much as a whole here in our society about what mental wellness or mental illnesses has been sold to us for profit rather than for the people themselves. So it really opened up this arena of looking at how can we support mental health in our society without making money off of it as the main issue. So that's how it wove into the Economic Justice Action Group. And this is happening all over. People are working on creating mental health in our communities. And what we've been able to do with Rethinking Psychiatry is bring a lot of these people together and to give them a platform to speak about what they've learned as far as helping people cope with the stress that they were talking about, with the anguish, with the being the greatest power in the world, military power in the world right now, and all these things that we are sort of have a lot of conflict about. I call it not mental illness, but emotional disturbance. So there are a lot of people and a lot of organizations. This is a movement. Its time has come, and it's happening. And Jan Hocken's film is an example of that.
Okay. Well, I noticed on your webpage, which is rethinkingpsychiatry.org, www.rethinkingpsychiatry.org, that you have speakers throughout the year too. And I'm going to make the assumption after reading what they talk about that they connect to the mission that you just talked about.
Exactly, which is educating. That's what it's all about. It's educating people as to all the resources that are out there. And that's not saying, I want to say this, make a declaration right now. We're not against medication. Medication works wonderfully in certain situations, but it's not the magic bullet. There's so much more to it, and we're so much more complex. And yes, we've been able to have people come to our monthly meetings and share what they're doing in their groups, their organizations, to lay a better, healthier foundation for all of us. So that's exactly our mission, is to sort of counteract this financial gain thing of describing what mental wellness is. We're living in a mental illness society, not a mental wellness, and we're changing that, and we are doing it.
Okay, and you mentioned education. I've viewed Jan's film, and Jan's viewed the full title of the film is Mind Zone, Therapists Behind the Front Lines. And just to plug it again and to plug the film festival, the festival opens with Jan's film on Thursday night at 9 o'clock, and that's at the First Unitarian Church here in Portland, but at 7 o'clock, I'm sorry. But what I want to ask about that film, as well as the other films, and you can talk about the other films because I haven't viewed them yet, is Jan's film has such complexities in terms of that connect to the mission that you're talking about. So you might talk about how you chose films in terms of the mission, as well as being an educator, because the organization, as you put it, is an educator. And so let's talk about Jan's film and the other films.
Okay? Well, I have to say, the amazing thing, and if you don't think things are changing, that the Army let this PhD psychologist with a crew.
That's Jan.
Jan, okay. Behind the front lines to see how our military is working with this very contradictory message of go back out there into this heinous situation, but we're going to make it better for you. We're going whatever. And it's a real conflict, and we get to watch the people who are doing that deal with this themselves. I think we're all dealing with, some people say we're all dealing with post-traumatic stress in this society because of all the stresses that are on us. So how do we deal with it? And that our military let her go back there, and now she's going to show us, and let's face it, with half of our money going to the military, this is foundational work. So the other films, Jan, you know,
And let me interrupt you for a second, because what's interesting about that, obviously, that's a huge question that we're not going to answer here about the military letting her go behind the scenes, or as they would put it, having her being embedded, which is one of those words we just want to get rid of. But on the other hand, when the people that she interviewed in that film, that's what I meant by complexities, were she developed them so well in a 52-minute film that you got to know these people and see their contradictions and their conflicts. And she also was able, although not for great lengths, to have a number of professionals, psychiatrists, that are highly critical of not that they be therapists behind the lines, but there be any lines. Okay. So talk to that for a bit.
And what this is about, it just is exciting to know. Part of our mission also states, and we all say, it's not about them and us, it's about all of us. And I think that this documentary really shows that. These aren't bad people. These are people who are working, as we all are, to change things for the better. And it's very, very, it's a very conflicted and also complicated matter. So what Rethinking Psychiatry, and especially our film festival, is doing is, we have six other Friday nights. It's going to be Friday nights after the February one. So all of the Friday nights in March, and these are all at the First Unitarian Church. And they all have to do with the way different organizations are creating mental health. These people behind the front lines, they're working to create mental health. That's a big job there. We also, one of the ones I'm really pleased with is Sisters of the Road. If you know about Sisters of the Road, right here in Portland, they are creating a community of mental health. And they're going to be showing a film about some an organization, I think it's in Philadelphia, where this same kind of community mental health, supporting one another's reality, is working. We also have the court-appointed special advocates, CASA, who will be showing a documentary that was shown on, I think it was 2020. And this is about the medication of foster children. The thing that we think, and I believe very strongly, is that pharmaceuticals and psychiatry can be used, and I'm afraid it is being used in lots of areas, as social control. And when you start drugging children, and it's increasing. As a teacher, I like to think it was when I retired that someone was going to take care of it. All of a sudden, I realized I have to take care of it. They are pathologizing more and more children. And I say that in our society, we pathologize and criminalize people who don't fit in the boxes. And that's what's happening very early on. So those are two of the films and groups. We ask groups to be part of the festival that support creating mental wellness.
That sounds great. So you've talked about three of the films, I think, in total, right? And what are the topics of the other films?
Marketing Madness, I guess that's the one that's going to be the first Friday of March. That's Marketing Madness. That talks about the pharmaceuticals and the whole industry that is a multi-billion dollar industry. So that's one I hope you will all come to. We also are going to have the film Milk. If any of you have seen that film where homosexuality was pathologized, this shows how subjective this whole arena is and that we all have to work together to make it more humane. That's our goal.
Well, it seems to me unbelievably that the films that you've mentioned all connect to your mission. They all connect to wanting to educate. Some people would have seen the film Milk before, but it's one of those types of things that it teaches in different ways each time that you see it. So what I'm thinking about is that this seems to me to be a great opportunity for people in Portland. The breadth and depth of these films, which touch the issues of kind of creating mental illness in a mentally ill society, really, really seem like they would be poignant. I know they are in Jan's movie. And so why don't you take we've got about a minute to go. Why don't you take the time to, again, give the place, time, how to view what the films are going to be online and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, very fine. Thank you. And thank you for this opportunity to come and share. This is an educational opportunity for everyone so that we can make good choices. As humans, we're very capable of that. It's, again, rethinkingpsychiatry.org. You can go to our website and see the various films and the times. They're all going to be 6:30 to 9 on the Friday nights starting in March. And the Unitarian Church, this is all taking place at the Unitarian Church, which is at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue. And it is, again, an economic justice issue to help educate everyone so we can make good choices about what is mentally healthy for us.
Thank you, Marcia Myers. It was really wonderful listening to you talk.
Mr. Kirk, Dexter's in school.
I'm afraid he's not, Miss Fishmore. Dexter's truancy problem is way out of hand. The Baltimore County School Board have decided to expel Dexter from the entire public school system.
Well, Mr. Kirk, I'm not fairly sure to learn Dexter's truancy, but surely expulsion is not the answer.
I'm afraid expulsion is the only answer. is the opinion of the entire staff that Dexter is criminally insane. Insane.
Oh, I wish we had more time for that. That was The Avalanche's Frontier Psychiatrist. And just before that, we heard an excellent interview with Alan Weider and Marcia Myers talking about Rethinking Psychiatry's film festival opening this Thursday. So, psychoanalytic philosopher Slavoj Žižek starred in a film some years back called The Pervert's Guide to Cinema, a movie that Žižek spends psychoanalyzing dozens of movies, from Fight Club to Duck Soup, from Wizard of Oz to Wild at Heart. Now Žižek and director Sophie Fiennes have joined forces again to make The Pervert's Guide to Ideology. Movie mold Joel Clement and philosophy professor Jason Reed will review this latest work. Go ahead.
The Pervert's Guide to Ideology is the second project that Slovenian philosopher and psychoanalytic thinker Slavoj Žižek has cooperated with Sophie Fiennes in making. The first one was called The Pervert's Guide to Cinema, and both films follow the same broad kind of format where they are looking at classic films and more contemporary films, and Slavoj Žižek is sometimes inserting himself into the films and making comments about both the particular content of the film, but more generally different issues related to psychoanalytic theory, and in the case of this most recent film, the various ways that ideology manifests. I'm joined with Jason Reed of the University of Southern Maine. He is a philosophy professor there who specializes in continental philosophy and, in particular, Marxist theory and feminist philosophy and their conjunction with films and popular culture. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
It starts out with an examination of John Carpenter's 1980-something classic, They Live. I was wondering, Jason, maybe if you could start out by kind of talking about the import of that film as Žižek brings it up and as how it kind of sets the tone for the whole film, The Pervert's Guide to Ideology.
Well, I mean, They Live is an often referred to film for people who want to talk about ideology. You know, it was made during the height of sort of the Reagan era and, you know, deals with the sort of down on his luck manual laborer who finds out that the world is being exploited by aliens or beings from some other planet, and much of the focus of the ideology in the film has to do with these sunglasses that allow you to see through the world, and underneath things like billboards you see just straight imperatives to consume against a stark black images against a white background. And Žižek sort of takes, I think, the basic point he takes from this film is, one, that we should think about ideology as not something that's imposed upon us by some forces, but actually it is our common sense way of viewing the film, and we need something like sunglasses to be able to cut through the images and see the imperatives and the rules underlying what appears to us to be normal everyday reality, which I guess is his framing device, somewhat how the way he sees himself in this film as providing us sunglasses, although it's not quite the same as the earlier film where he directly alluded to the Matrix and sort of taking the pill to be able to see. The film plays the same sort of role here, although less explicitly.
This film is really, really long, and we should say that it is part of the Portland International Film Festival, and another showing of it will be this Thursday at Cinema 21 in Northwest Portland. I believe it starts at 8:30, but it's a 2.5-hour film, so make sure to drink some coffee before you come. He looks at many films as well as Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Some of the films that he looks at include The Sound of Music, West Side Story, Full Metal Jacket, A Clockwork Orange, The Fall of Berlin, Titanic, Brazil by Terry Gilliam, and The Last Temptation of Christ. What do you think, Jason, he is trying to do trying to get us to do in looking at popular films and saying that there is mortal significance to the way that they teach us to think about things?
Well, sometimes he presents these films sort of juxtaposing a popular film and a film that is not only not popular, but may reflect a rather different historical and thus ideological point of view. Like, I'm thinking about the fact that he talks about Jaws relatively early on in the film, and how the question around Jaws, as the question around a lot of monster movies, is what does the shark mean? What does it signify? What is the symbol for? And he points out that, you know, Fidel Castro himself said that the shark sort of symbolized capitalism, sort of tearing apart this idyllic small beach town community, or it could be any, you know, it could be anything, right? That's partly his point. The shark could be any possible threat to this little slice of Americana. Then he quickly shifts to looking at anti-Semitic films from Nazi Germany and pointing out that the Jew figured as also a kind of complicated mixture of different symbols. Right? The Jew could be simultaneously Karl Marx and the sort of proletarian revolution and the plutocrats, the Jewish plutocrats who were, you know, milking the country dry or whatever. And all these concrete things are possible. So it sometimes seems like he wants to use the films to introduce ideas, but also to set up this weird kind of schism between the popular and the not so popular. He does the same thing later with Titanic and the Fall of Berlin, where he juxtaposes a film that's very familiar to us to a film that's of a different ideological perspective, which supposedly, I think, is supposed to illustrate ideology itself, as well as cast some kind of question on the film that seems so normal and common sense to us, although I don't know what this means for sharks in the case of Jaws. But
well, you tuned into the Old Mole Variety Hour. My name is Joe Clement. I'm speaking with Jason Reed about Slavoj Žižek and Sophie Fine's film, The Pervert's Guide to Ideology, which is part of the Portland International Film Festival. So this is a long film, but what makes it a bit more bearable is that it's broken up into digestible segments of, you know, usually no more than 5 minutes each. And I found that by the end of the film, like with the first Pervert's Guide to Cinema, there was, I think, more something more compelling or more emotionally exploratory, particularly when Žižek turns to Terry Gilliam's brilliant film, Brazil, and he is making a point of about how bureaucracy reproduces itself almost, you know, joylessly, and that there's a certain kind of duty that we realize in encountering its demands, or in kind of realizing that it's not going to tell us what we need to do with ourselves, but that we need to act directly. And I thought that this was a strangely kind of anarchist interpretation for Slavoj Žižek, who has otherwise kind of flirted with crypto-Stalinism at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although it seems interesting because the other point, and I think this is part of the problem of both Žižek and of ideology too, in the sense that he goes from to Brazil from the movie Seconds, in which the lesson there is all about how a guy is, even when his life is radically transformed, it's incredibly unsatisfying because he still has the same dream, and that to some extent there's this question about this dream that is both impossible to realize, but yet we're attached to it, and is all the more constricting in that we're attached to it. And there seems to be a way in which he sometimes wants to say that it's very important that we act, but he also wants to say it's equally important that we try to realize the fantasies that structure our actions. So he leaves himself kind of caught between this sense that maybe we are subjected to society in ways that go deeper than we'd ever know, or maybe it's possible for us sort of act first and free ourselves from these imperatives. He can't quite decide on that point, but that seems to be part of the problem of thinking about ideology.
You get the impression from Žižek in a very paranoid sense that the world is nothing but these traps for us to fall into, and that the capitalist global order in particular has become very adept at using these emotional traps, if you will, to exploit us for consumerist ends. And I sometimes find that to be kind of a compelling way of looking at things, say, with the Coke commercial. And yet he seems to want to shut down any redemptive value of various liberation oriented rhetoric that came out of, like, the, as he refers to it, the hippie movement or the sexual revolution.
Yeah, I mean, he only really, I mean, I think this is somewhat explicit for him. He only has, like, problems to offer. I mean, he only, and the film sometimes seems like, sometimes the films sort of reinforce each other, but sometimes they go in absolute sort of tension with each other in that they, I mean, on the one hand, he seems to suggest at one point that it's ideology to think yourself to have a kind of critical distance to what you believe. This is the West Side Story song where the gang in West Side Story sort of give a sociological account of their own condition. He critically points out that that's, that sense of having a critical distance from what you believe is ideology. That you say to the world, oh, I'm just acting this way. I mean, he loves to point this out about, you know, this sort of his fantasy object of a sort of educated, an educated white supremacist in Europe who sort of talks about the breakdown of society and social norms in an articulate fashion to justify their own actions. So there's one point where he's like, ideology is that point where you think you're outside of ideology. But then his other point, say with Taxi Driver, is to suggest that ideology is the inability to see how what you're trying to do, like liberate this, you know, this girl and save her from the streets, is all caught up with this fantasy of her victimhood and your heroic nature, and that it's you're too deeply intertwined in your belief system to have any critical distance. So it's like you're leaving the film sometimes thinking, wait, is critical distance good or bad? Is acting good or bad? And these, I don't think he can really answer these kinds of questions. And at best, he can offer a sort of tension between two different points of view. And at worst, he can just sort of produce infinitely new readings of films that are simultaneously engaging and frustrating, but don't go anywhere, but wait for the next film to come along to point out how that, too, is an example of his ideology.
Well, that is all the time we have for today. I have been talking with Jason Reed, professor of philosophy at University of Southern Maine, about Slavoj Žižek and Sophie Fine's new, very long documentary, kind of a philosophical exploration called The Pervert's Guide to Ideology. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thank you.
Well, that song obviously needs no explanation. We just heard Joe Clement talking with Jason Reed about The Pervert's Guide to Ideology, Slavoj Žižek's latest foray into the world of entertainment. Concluding our show today, Alan Weider draws the connection between sports and society and shares his analysis of racism and bigotry in the Israeli soccer world.
Thanks, Ivan. What I'm going to call this is soccer and societal bigotry, Israeli style. The visibility of racism in soccer rose 2 months ago when AC Milan star Kevin Prince Boateng protested racist chants and then kicked the ball into the stands and walked off the pitch, followed by his teammates, the opposing side, coaches, and referees. After the incident, there was global support as well as demands for FIFA, soccer's international governing body, to take substantive rather than public relations actions against racism in the sport. Now we have another shrill example from Israel, where there are racist protests because soccer club Beitar Jerusalem have signed two Muslim players. Beitar has a long history of racism and xenophobia. Racism in Israeli soccer corresponds directly to the bigotry that is prevalent in Israeli society. In Israel, however, the racism is magnified because of the discrimination and oppression of Palestinians, a practice that some people around the world, including the prestigious Bertrand Russell Tribunal, refer to as apartheid. Beitar Jerusalem has a long Zionist history that matches the political foundation of the club. The Beitar movement was founded in Latvia as a right-wing political movement in 1923. According to Beitar's webpage, the new youth movement aimed at educating its members with a military and nationalistic spirit, and Beitar partnered in attacks on the Palestinian population before, during, and following World War II. Founded in 1936, the team became successful in the late 70s. The team's history has been racist and exclusionary. In 76 years, there has never been an Arab player, in spite of the fact that Arabs play on teams throughout all three divisions of Israeli soccer. In addition, the team has signed only a handful of Muslims, and in some of those cases, the religion of the player was hidden by team management. A decade ago, a Nigerian Muslim player was signed to play with Beitar Jerusalem. He was viciously harassed by the team's fans with chants of Kushi, the N-word in Hebrew, and there were monkey calls as fans threw bananas at him on the pitch. If more venomous behavior is possible, the Beitar Jerusalem fans have saved their worst harassment for Arab players on opposing teams. There are many more racist anti-Arab incidents revolving around Beitar Jerusalem. How can you even begin to address this hatred when fans still take pride in a pregame chant that includes, "Here it comes, the racist team of the country"? There are Israelis, mostly on the left, that fight and challenge the oppression of Palestinians by their country, and some believe that it is getting more difficult to confront Israeli racism and bigotry. Hebrew University historian Moshe Zimmerman writes that Israelis cite Beitar Jerusalem extremism in order to avoid the fact that bigotry is presently more pronounced and that Israeli society on the whole is getting more racist or at least more ethnocentric. The announcement of the signings of the two Muslim players came just before the Israeli election, and the reaction of at least some of the Beitar Jerusalem fan base was swift and venomous. The fans' racism was evident at two Beitar Jerusalem matches just after the signings. Ironically, the first match was on the eve of International Holocaust Remembrance Day, yet the fans' bigotry imploded on players from the rival team. A banner read, "Beitar Forever Pure," and there were chants of "Death to Arabs, Death to Muslims, and No Entry to Arabs." After the match, the actions of Beitar fans were condemned by Likud politicians who are among the fan base of Beitar Jerusalem. But there was neither depth nor breadth in their declarations. The Speaker of Parliament, Reuven Rivlin, chastised the fans, and the Jerusalem Mayor Barkat also condemned Beitar Jerusalem, but he misrepresented the problem as belonging solely to a segment of Beitar Jerusalem fans. Like Rivlin, his main argument was that the actions of the hooligans would affect Jews adversely throughout the world. The strongest statement came from former Prime Minister Olmert, who criticized fan actions as hatred, contempt, disgust, and intolerance of the darkest kind, adding, "This issue should concern us all. If we do not remove these racists from our stadium and disconnect them from the team, we will be just like them." While it is difficult to argue with Olmert's condemnation, it too implies that there is a small problem to fix. And none of the political condemnations of Beitar Jerusalem dare to make connections to the present reality in terms of the anti-Arab and anti-Palestinian actions of the government they help run. However, condemnation did not stop the fans from even worse displays of bigotry 2 days later when they played against a predominantly Arab team. Ironically, the first banner seen at the stadium read, "Beitar fans against violence and racism." Although hopeful, it was dwarfed by other signs and incessant rantous chanting. The views of Beitar Jerusalem fans were clear as they left the stadium. Comments included, "Arabs are impure people, and all Palestinians are terrorists." Might it be that for Beitar Jerusalem hooligans, as well as other Israeli people, "all Palestinians are terrorists" equates to an oppressive colonial anti-Muslim and possibly apartheid disposition that is part of the Israeli psyche and is promoted by the beliefs and actions of Israel's current government, including the leaders cited above who condemned the racist hooligans. And that said, the issue of bigotry and racism within Israeli soccer cannot be divorced from the same racism in Israeli society. Jody Ruderin writes that the current government enacted at least 20 new laws that discriminate against Arab Israeli citizens, including neighborhood housing covenants. In addition, the Coalition Against Racism reported that during 2011 and 12, racist incidents in Israel had risen by close to 30%. There is no question that the overt racism of Beitar Jerusalem soccer fans corresponds to the bigotry that exists in Israeli society. The team fan club, La Familia, is representative of the far-right anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, and anti-Palestinian segment of Israeli society and, of course, needs to be dealt with. But it might also be that Beitar fans who are softer, or it's more famous fans who condemn the racism but ignore the societal reality and actually promote the oppression of Palestine through their support and facilitation of settlements and IDF violent oppression are the bigger problem. Unfortunately, Israeli leaders, just as other leaders throughout the world, do not make the society-sport connection. In Israel, it is more stark, because Palestinian oppression is both harsh and deadly. Might the Beitar Jerusalem racism help us make the link? This has been Alan Weider for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
All right. Well, thanks, Alan. Again, that was Alan Weider telling us his commentary on the connection between sports and society, racism and bigotry in Israel. That draws us to a close today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. We've heard from Bill Resnick and Ben Goldacre. We've heard from Joe Clement and Jason Reed talking about Slavoj Žižek's latest movie. We've heard from Alan Weider and Marcia Myers talking about Rethinking Psychiatry's the upcoming film festival starting this Thursday night at 7 p.m. Up next, we have, it looks like Air Cascadia is off today, so we'll hear an excerpt from Between the Lines. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, host Barbara Bernstein talks with author Andrew Nikiforuk, a journalist based in Alberta whose award-winning book, Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, exposes this disaster in the making. You can hear this show and many others in KBOO website. You can download it and like us on Facebook, the Old Mole Variety Hour, and become a fan. You can get all of our shows in segments and in their entirety that you can listen to at your leisure. Thank you again. It's been wonderful. Have a great week. Bye-bye.
KBOO would like to invite you to Once in a Boom Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs. Hear Henry and Moggy, the True Vine Ramblers, Don McLaren and his Fiddlin' Friends, and Retta Christie and her One Night Stand Band. That's Once in a Boom Moon at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church on Saturday, February 23rd from 7 to 10 p.m. Doors open at 6, so come early, as also included are delectable desserts with coffee, a silent auction, and raffles. For more information, go to the Once in a Boom Moon webpage at kboo.fm.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 10 o'clock straight up. Instead of Air Cascadia, we're going to hear an excerpt from Between the Lines.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with hip-hop poet, musician, and political activist Hassan Salaam. Mr. Salam, thanks for talking with me. I wanted to start out by asking you, I was looking over some of your music, and I was looking at
When President Obama signed the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, civil liberties advocates were alarmed at several provisions, including Section 1021, that empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. On January 13th last year, two lawyers, Carl J. Mayer and Bruce I. Afrin, filed a lawsuit on behalf of seven plaintiffs challenging the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions of the NDAA. Their plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's most well-known dissident and MIT linguist Noam Chomsky. On May 16th last year, U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of New York, Catherine Forrest, issued a preliminary injunction that barred the U.S. government from applying indefinite military detention of U.S. citizens. Later on September 12th, Judge Forrest issued a permanent injunction declaring Section 1021 of the NDAA unconstitutional. In response, the Obama administration appealed the decision to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which issued a stay of the injunction pending the outcome of the government's case. Your reporter spoke with Carl Mayer, one of the two attorneys in the case, who talks about oral arguments made before the three-judge panel of the appellate court in New York City on February 6th.
The law is unconstitutional. It goes against our most basic principles. Judge Forrest not only granted a preliminary injunction, but she granted a permanent injunction back in September. As soon as Judge Forrest granted the permanent injunction, the Obama Justice Department went crazy. At 11 o'clock on a Friday night, they indicated they were filing papers first thing on the following Monday morning, asking for a stay of the Judge Forrest opinion, and they immediately appealed it. And that's, in fact, what they did do. And unfortunately, the Second Circuit, which is the appellate court, federal appellate court, did grant them a stay until the appeal was heard, and the appeal was heard